Now today, you can probably hear some birds and ducks in the background because I've taken a journey up to Queensland to actually sit physically with Kevin Moore on his beautiful balcony on a canal really near the sea because we've been finishing off our Road to Online Retail course, doing our final little pieces ready to launch.
And because we're actually now allowed to physically be in the same space because the COVID laws have allowed us to cross borders.
Yes, and we're not quite sure for how long here in Australia.
No, we're not, no.
Because things are not quite going as well as they were. But I was having a chat with Kevin the other day, and I wanted to know more about Kevin's journey into online retail, because I've known Kevin for years, and he was the marketing expert on shopper experience for physical, but he has made this huge transition into online and tied in with Toys R Us. How did that all happen? So today we're going to explore that. How did you start an online retail business from scratch and make it into a very successful, much larger online business? So we're going to go down that journey. But also, Kevin, you've been involved with an awful lot of other businesses along the way, both online and non-online. And I want to explore some of the things you've learned and where you've learned to come up with this idea of the second age of online retail.
So I guess as I started to immerse myself, so on the earliest podcast, I talked about the fact that I had immersed myself in a small agency that did all things digital, sitting alongside 20-somethings for 90 minutes a week and just really eating a lot of humble pie. I was quite dismissive of online, having been a professional marketer and a retail marketer for years in the physical environment. And it really was quite humbling to see the reach and power, understand the reach and power of online. It blew me away. Because the work I was doing with a lot of physical retailers, or people who had physical businesses, I was asked more and more to be involved in their business to help them on that journey. Generally speaking, the journey was people saying, we know we need to do this, so we ought to start doing it, rather than, I'm passionate about this, I want to do it. And hey, I was exactly the same. It wasn't a thing, this is not about, you know, if I've seen far, it's because I've stood on the shoulders of giants. It isn't that whole thing about being ahead of people. The majority of us get taken there. I've used the phrase many, many times. I haven't had an original idea in my life. Any wealth I've created for me and my family has been from following trends. I'm quite a fast follower. I do trust that where the wind's blowing and say, well, let's understand that and move forward, rather than be cynical and say, no, I'm not going to do that. But that describes the majority of us. There are very few of us who are genuinely first movers. And they're amazing people. I'm not one of them. So some of the work I started to do, I was working with a fourth generation wine retailer. Christina Tullock's a lovely lady. Her dad's an amazing winemaker. The business is 120 years old. And they were doing more and more work online, and they had a membership base that needed to grow. So what we tried to do on that one was take, again, all those physical attributes and say, how do we start to bring those alive? How do we tell the story of this fourth generation, a daughter in the wine industry, going back through the different relatives over the years who've done amazing things, the story behind how they actually won the winery through, you know, there was a debt that needed to be paid back, all these wonderful stories, and also to bring alive the fact that you're dealing with amazing wineries, you know, the budding of wine, the budding of grapes at key times of the year. Summer in the Hunter Valley in Australia is beautiful. How do you capture that imagery? And we worked hard to develop that. It became an amazing thing. We actually ended up with a significant increase in the number of members, online transactions increased, and we brought alive through the website an awful lot of that. And in fact, Nigel, you helped me with that. So you came and did a lot of filming for Tullock.
Well, I was at the bleeding edge of technology doing some 360 videos.
You were indeed.
And that was another story, but anyway.
Yeah, so we did. So we did innovative things at that point. We put cameras on Harleys and rode around, you know, wineries. We captured the feel of that. But that was one part of it. Another one happened. There was a major retailer involved in news distribution, a news agency, to use an Australian and UK term. And they were in significant decline. And it was how we started to offer things that were digital, all things digital. The reality is there are bigger issues facing that industry. As we've seen with media, we've seen mastheads close all around the world. But it was starting to get people to put their toe in the water. That was a difficult one. I don't need to name the brand. That was difficult because it was such an embedded industry. I mean, the whole concept of a news agency was the fact that you were protected by government. Only certain people could sell newsprint. If you come from that environment, it's very difficult to embrace change. I mean, we just don't do it. Change is thrust upon us. did a great piece of work with the largest airport in Australia, Sydney Airport. And that was all around how we got landside. So as people came to the airport, how they flowed through as quickly as possible. And that was adopting and looking into technology online, the second age of online, if you will. Things that aren't obvious, we don't think of those being online. But Uber is online. You know, ground transport is online. I can be picked up, I can be dropped off super swift, super fast. And that was a key part of moving traffic through. Being able to book online for coaches and being able to push the government, the state government, to be able to allow people to use trains in an easier way so they didn't have to end up with buying tickets that had a high face value they couldn't use. All sorts of these things that aren't obvious, but they're part of the second age. Then I met Dr. Lewis Mattoni, who at that point was running Mattoni Technology, a distribution company in Australia, who had just started Hobby Warehouse. And that was where we both really started to work together, both with a passion for the space, but limited experience. And I think that's the key thing about sharing two different abilities. He's a brilliantly left brain man, a code developer, phenomenally logical, phenomenal intelligence, and I'm right brain. And being able to get those things together and respecting each other's views on things gave us this amazing and very fast-growing business. Now, one of the key things about that is when you go from a business-to-business company, so something selling products to other companies, to a shopper-focused company, you have to completely retrain the mindset of the business because they're very different decisions. I mean, corporations, companies, people buying things on behalf of companies do it for different reasons. We talk about quality, price, movement, profit, and service. This, don't worry about it. But these are some of the things that a rational decision maker in a corporation will use to decide what they buy. Shoppers, we don't do that.
Can we just go back a fraction there, though? So Dr. Lewis Mattoni was a distributor of
electronics. It was electronic, so everything that you have on your desk around here, Nigel, in some shape or form, he would sell. So into resellers, into companies reselling, so onto retailers.
So how did he make that transition to
passion?
Hobby.
Passion.
Okay.
Here you go. Values and passion. So he was passionate about hobbies and wanted to be able to present people with a choice of having hobbies in their lives. Over time, we distilled out the essence of the business, the essence of the brand. But he was passionate about it. And here's the thing. I'm a great believer. This goes back to that comment about, you know, people get pushed into things. People get pushed into things. They think they ought to do it. But once they get into it and they see it and their minds are opened, then they develop passion. And that's what he did. An amazing passion. So he secured amazing things, started to source remote control yachts and design his own remote control cars around the world. And that just naturally blended in from hobbies into play. But the important thing about that, on that journey, one of the greatest things that Lewis does is listens and acts. Now, that doesn't mean that what he does is blindly follow every word that's thrown at him. Critical thinking. He thinks critically about what's being proposed to him and says, does that have a position? If he decides it does have a position and relevance in his business, he applies it quickly. So that's speed, and online just really lends itself to speed because you can do it so fast.
But what was his original ambition? I mean, starting a online business that, you know, encourages your hobbies sounds like it's a nice thing to play with. Was it always envisioned to be a big business?
No, I don't think any of us do that. The majority of us start businesses that we own and run ourselves. So we start doing it to feed our family. We do it because we see there's an opportunity there. And it should be something that people will, it will resonate with other people, that whole curation thing, it will resonate with other people. And I think that's what he did. Lewis just thought, I want to do this. This is, I can, it's my own business, so I can do this. I have the warehousing, I have the knowledge, I understand online. He'd been also selling gaming technology, so things like NZXT and Thrustmaster for gamers out there. So he understood the whole online gaming section, which is a hobby, it's a passion, it's an e-sport, it's a hobby. So he started that and we worked together and it was a pleasure to be involved. I mean, we bounced off each other, we sparked off each other and created this amazing relationship, which now is 5-6 years old. On that journey, things were happening and it leads into the Toys R Us. When the physical retails were changing around the world, we'd been talking to each other about the fact that physical retail was in decline. Every leading indicator out of the US and the UK was saying this is declining. All the research we were starting to read, but from the manufacturers who sold their products into retailers, were seeing their share of online retail customers growing whilst the share of their physical retail customers was declining. And I don't mean that the physical retailers were a smaller share of the same size of pie. They were a smaller share of the same size of pie. They were genuinely in decline. This wasn't the pie was growing. They were genuinely in decline. And the rate of change, the rate of growth in the online was just unbelievable. But they also were in this dichotomy. It's difficult to balance your businesses when you're selling to physical retailers and online retailers, because buyer-supplier power means that often a physical retailer will say, if you sell to that online retailer, I may not give you the prominence in my stores that you had previously. It's just reality. That's negotiation. That's what happens in life. So a lot of the guys in the different industries were very cautious about getting involved with online retailers. And I'm not going to name them, but some of the guys we spoke to from Hobby Warehouse wouldn't do business with us for 3 years until we grew and grew and grew, until their own source of business into physical retail had declined so far they had to make that decision. When they did, they were blown away. So to put in perspective, again, I'm not going to name names, but one of the businesses that we took on, one of the lines we took on, we bought in our opening order more stock than any physical retailer had bought that month. I remember we're a small online retailer, and we weren't being funny. That's what we needed. Remember, we could reach 1.1 million people. In the first month, we sold that out in less than, I think, 10 days. We reordered double that. We'd done four times. So by the time we got to our 4 month, we were doing more volume online than the rest of the retailers, physical retailers, had bought that month in Australia. That's the rate of growth. And it's a small category. So when you get your head around the reach, that humility, the reach and power of online, it changes everything. And that's what we saw. So we continued that journey. We then saw that Toys R Us could no longer operate in the market as a physical retailer. And they did the right thing. They exited the market by paying everybody. Everybody got paid in Australia and New Zealand. And then the guys who had taken on Toys R Us Kids, which is the licensing body that owns the IP, the intellectual property, looked for partners in Australia and New Zealand. And they ran a process, an interview process, if you will, a pitch process, a tender process, whatever term you'd like. And they looked at, we believe, 6 to 8 players. Established online retailers and very well established and long-term physical retailers. What struck them was the research that we were presenting was the same research that they had been reading, which is about the future of online retail. And they knew they were making a decision in 2018, 2019, that would have its true play out in 2023, 24, 25. And it was a bold decision. I mean, a genuinely bold decision. And they looked at our strategy, they looked at our relationship with the brands, they looked at our understanding, the right brain, the soft elements of it. They understood our relationship with their brand. Toys R Us and Babies R Us are loved brands. You know, they're 60, 70 years old. They've been almost all our lives, all of our lives, as we sit here, and our children's lives and our grandchildren's lives. And they wanted a custodian and a guardian and a shepherd for a brand that was important to them. And a combination of that digital and that understanding the brands and at the strategy we're proposing, they said, guys, we're going to try this and we're going to use you as our petri dish. We're going to use you as our little chemistry project. We're going to watch you and see what you do. And then we can take those learnings from Australia and we can apply them to different parts of the world.
So your point of difference over the bigger, more established online and online physical retailers was the fact that you had such a strong focus on the shopper experience.
Twofold. So we were very focused on the shopper. And our shopper was in a specific category. So remember, Toys R Us was a category killer back in the day. They were called category killers. They did one sector really, really, really well. So Toys R Us started in the 50s, and they had one store and a few SKUs and a few products in their store. And then they had bigger stores with more products. Then they had more bigger stores. Then they had much more, much bigger stores. And they focused on that category. And we were a category killer. We weren't a marketplace. We weren't trying to sell, you know, everything from batteries and shoes and toys. We were toys and we were hobbies and we were going to clearly understand the baby sector too.
But when they were still here as a physical retailer, were they also dabbling online?
Oh yeah, and respect. So the last CEO of Toys R Us did a phenomenal job. She led that business. She was one of the people who truly understood that this was real, online was real. She recruited a very, very good team. They were growing so fast. But the realities of the global brand and the issues it faced in markets upstream from us. Remember, Australia's, we're protected. We're 3 years behind the opportunities and the pain of North America and Western Europe. We are. You know, we sit at the bottom of the planet and we're protected. So the pain that they were going through meant that really good work that was taking place here, the learnings coming out of North America being applied to this business and what she was doing here was fantastic work. So all credit to her, she did an amazing job. And in fact, over the process, she reached out to us and said, guys, I'd love to see what you're doing with the brand. You know, great. All the things we're talking about are now coming alive with a focus just on the online. They were doing a good job. They were just starting to turn the corner.
But the physical dragged them down.
Yeah. Because of footfall, not because of anything they were doing wrong. Remember, at the same time as they were facing issues here, our own retailers, who had nothing to do with that sector, who had no exposure to North America or exposure to Europe, were shuttering. They were going out of business.
So in the overall story here, we've talked before about you applying the shopper experience physical elements to try and create emotion and attachment and all the other things in the online world. When did you start to see that working with Hobby Warehouse?
Oh, it's very fast. So again, that's one of the greatest things about online. We would make a change to something. We would shoot a video. We'd boost something on Facebook. We would, no matter what it was, and you could see within hours the impact. Within hours. And it's for people who are obsessive compulsive like you and I, Nigel, and like a lot of people that we work with, that immediacy is unbelievable. And you go, wow, so let's play with that, let's do that. We could do things with pricing that you can never do in physical retail, not because you don't know what to do, but because it takes so long to feed.
Well, that was one of your other technologies you're involved in, which were the...
Shelf labels, yeah. So, I mean, the Home Depot in the USA runs the same technology that we sell in Australia. And it's a product called Display Data. And it is fantastic technology. They've got 2,005, I think, of their stores in the US are now running this. That meant that they were able to, on Black Friday and Cyber Monday, they were able to run absolutely aligned pricing in-store and on their website for the 4 days that was happening, and then seamlessly be able to take all their pricing across their digital assets and their physical assets up in exactly the same. It's just, and that's the thing, and so sometimes I think people listen to what I'm saying, oh, physical retail is dead. No, bad physical retail is dying. Physical retailers that can't change and don't have a vision, physical retailers that don't, like Toys R Us did in Australia, have a female CEO who goes, we can do this, and embraces the change. I mean, it was fantastic to see.
Yeah, it was funny because I was actually talking to, I was calling my goddaughter, who I've known since she was a couple of weeks old and is now in her 30s, today, and she's been working for a big hardware store over here called Bunnings. She started in March, just at the beginning of COVID, working for the digital team, and they have just been...
They've done a great job.
...exploding done a great job. Stuff.
So again, that was the vision of a CEO coming in saying, I'm going to do this. Lots of them are going from the markets. So by the markets, I mean the financial markets. Oh, you're not going to invest money in that online thing and not make money, are you? And he said, I've got to do this. And a crisis, a change. Remember COVID?
But also those changes are hard because an organization like that responds, they're basically their self-contained entities per store. So you've got to get them to buy into the concept. And the same with a lot of the electronics retailers over here. If you're a franchisee, what's in it for you for online?
So the two separate issues. So the large retailers that are centrally controlled are much, much better and have proven around the world to be much, much better at embracing online because there is a single call to action. There's a single purpose. They're there to provide service to their shoppers. When the leaders in those businesses understand that the best way they can provide that service, continuing service, is to truly embrace online, they're away. They can put together strategies, they can roll it out across their businesses with a single purpose. And people line up, and it takes a long time because they're big beasts to turn. But when they do turn, it all comes together. And the point I was going to make about COVID, all COVID has done is accelerate a behavioral change that was already happening. Now, not to be confused about this, we were going online in droves. And one of the things I was going to touch on this week is in the UK, the last quarter's retail sales came out. 33.4% of every pound spent in the United Kingdom was spent online. Not in a category, 33.4% of every pound that came from a shopper was spent online. Now, people say, that's COVID. Great, it's COVID. So by the time the retailers who were not able to deal with this have closed their stores, by the time that the behaviours that we've developed over 3, 4, 5 months become embedded in the way we shop, it's going to drop to 31. And then it will continue to grow it. This isn't going back. I still have conversations. I had a conversation with a very successful, very wealthy Australian retailer who still to this day believes that online cannot make money. Now, the first trillionaire on the planet is a guy called Jeff Bezos. Guess what he does? He sells online. But it's a mindset. So it is unusual to find, it is now less unusual, but it has been unusual to find leaders in physical retail who genuinely believe, not because the market's told them they should do, not because of optics, which people talk about, because they truly believe this is a way to create a great shopper experience. If I take you back to the issue you talk about franchisees, it's tough to do. you know, you're saying there's a centralized point of purpose, and you can buy these items from a .com.au.co.nz .co.uk site, but that is taking away from the franchise in that postcode, that zip code, and that's what they're struggling with. And, you know, for all the challenges and all the great things about franchises, it's a more complex model. Some are getting through it. There isn't an obvious one that springs to mind, but you know, people are trying to find their way through it.
I guess the only thing I can think of on that front is, you know, people like the franchisees who take on cafe brands and stuff like that, if they get supported with ordering, online ordering and stuff like that, but it's local delivery.
Yeah. The Uber Eats model, fantastic. So harnessing Uber Eats and fantastic. Menulog, great. You're absolutely right. So in that space, it's working. In the physical retailing of things, it's tougher. Mm. So I won't mention the name. My mum's always said to me, if you haven't got anything nice to say, Kevin, don't say it. And she's 87. She's a very powerful woman, very strong woman, frightens me at times. But there's one of the largest retailers on the planet had a terrible decline in footfall into their stores in the back end of 2019, so before COVID. Their online offering was so confusing for the shopper. I tried to shop them, I'd heard about it, and I did really try to shop them. I wasn't going to buy from them. They're a great retailer. But I tried this out, and it was absolutely true. They had this bizarre thing where their online inventory was store-based. So I could be in a postcode, I could be in a zip code, and I could go online, and the item wasn't in that store that week. Now, it was in a store 10 kilometers away, you know, 6 miles away, but I wasn't in that catchment area, so I couldn't get it. And I went through this process of calling them each week and saying, is it in? Just missed it. Is it in? Oh, it's gone. It was crazy. Now, I gather they've now solved that, and they announced we've now invested in our online systems and processes. There's another major retail that went through an upgrade in Australia, struggled significantly. They're a physical retailer. They've lost most of their competition in their sector, and their online offering was rolled out and it failed. They had to roll out their previous offering. So again, it is this, get the best and the brightest and pay them the most. You can't do that. I've got these guys in my business who are 20-year retailers. You can't give me this, you know, guy and girl's been around for 10 years and pay them more money, because they're the future. Mm. They're the future of retail.
So just going back again to what you were saying earlier with the journey with Hobby Warehouse, so, you know, Lewis had the idea and the passion to build this up. What were the key milestones along the way, and where were the moments that were most stressful, but also where you began to think, oh, this is big?
I think I can answer that question, and people listening who have grown businesses, they're the same squeeze points. We have working capital, we have banks to deal with, we have supplier terms to deal with. They're not, none of them are different. Fast-growing businesses just have issues that they face. So none of them were different, the things I've talked about. I think the difference with online is you can see the changes. So the problems of getting suppliers to support you, some of the biggest payment companies with payment terms, we approached them and they wouldn't return our calls. We weren't important. When we took on the Toys R Us and Babies R Us franchise, our phones rang off the hook. That's just reality. And you don't mind that. And you don't go, oh no, because you're so mean to me. Hey, this is about the shopper. It's not about us. It's not about you. It's about the shopper. And straight away we said, yeah, what can we do? How can we work with you? The marketplaces? Likewise, absolutely work with the marketplaces. But it's the immediacy. It's, you can see when you take on a new line, when you change your pricing slightly, when you do a particularly quirky piece of social media, when we put randomly put toilet gift wrapped toilet paper, those rolls in toys that went out. That was great. It just ran. When we did the free shipping for grandparents, it became evident that grandparents would not see their grandchildren. I mean, you know this. I met you with my grandchildren and your daughter, you know, 700 kilometres away. It was the first time we'd seen them in 6 months. So it's obviously evident that grandparents couldn't be with children. So how could we facilitate it and make it easy for them? And when we did that, again, it was on trust. The little box you tick, I'm a grandparent. Tick. Anybody can tick it. So it goes back to your values, goes back to trust. And you can see those things happen. It's good to see. You know you're going the right way when you have that immediate feedback, that really fast feedback.
And were there any pivot points where you had to change direction?
Oh, yeah. It's funny, the pivot points tend to be physical. What happens is you run a business and it starts to grow, and your physical infrastructure outgrows the demand of shoppers. Everybody goes, oh, nice problem to have. Yeah, it is a nice problem to have, but remember, when you do that, when you get those squeeze points, the first thing you do is you compromise service, because you can't get orders out fast enough and you can't have the range of product that you want. Your teams, your pick, pack, dispatch teams have to learn new locations. There's a lot of things going on. So that's the key thing, and it's the capital to invest and to be able to have the infrastructure keep up with the demand that you're creating.
Okay. So yesterday we had a little outing to one of your other investments.
Yes.
Which was the new face of online retail, or new face of retail, in fact. So we went across...
went to West Burley. So we went about 4 kilometres from here. So it's about 300 metres from one of the biggest freeway systems on the east coast of Australia. So couriers and trucks run up and down it. What we looked at was a purpose-built development of 18 warehouse offices combined. So the office space is above the warehouse space, beautifully fitted out. It's like you're walking into an apartment. So when you go to buy these things, you actually see the fittings of the taps and the fittings of the toilet roll holders, how the kickboards are going to be, what the carpets are going to be. This is a place where a business owner is going to spend 50, 60, 70, 80 hours a week in their business. They want to be comfortable. They're close to the stock. When we looked at those, they're 150 square metres, so 100 square metres of warehousing space, 50 square metres of air-conditioned office space. You can probably get between $120,000 and $150,000 worth of inventory in that space. You can turn that 8 to 10 times a year. You've got a beautiful business, a beautiful online business that you don't have to bring shoppers to you anymore. Shoppers come to your site and you ship to the country. You ship nationally, but you actually end up shipping internationally as well. But it is absolutely the future of retail.
And the other thing being curbside pickup, which is getting more and more popular.
Yeah, people will pop in and then they can come and pick something up in the local area. It's a nice to have, but the reality is it's a self-contained thing. It just took me back. I remember when people first went into retail, when retail was really booming. So the mid-80s and the early 90s, and it was just the shopping malls around the world. Paco Underhill captured it all in Why We Buy and The Call of the Mall, brilliant books. And we saw that happening and people would go and take a shop in a small strip mall or in a mini mall because they couldn't afford to be in the big malls. That was the domain of the, you know, the big brands. But they'd do that and they'd feed their family for 10, 15 years. They'd be retailers and they'd have giftware stores. They'd do whatever it was and they could do that. And then footfall declined and things changed and online came of age.
But the other big difference here is that in the days of small retailers, you didn't need a phenomenal amount of skill. Whereas with online, yes, okay, maybe in the warehousing, you may not need to know quite so much. But the barrier to entry is a little higher, I would suggest, for some people. What would you say about that?
Yes, but I think that the line, sadly, is chronological. So I know lots of very, very young 72-year-olds, and I know lots of very, very old 21-year-olds. The mindset for somebody under the age of about 35 with online, they've spent most of their life in an online environment. So remember, Jeff Bezos, 1998, so been for 22 years now. So they've been exposed to online for some time. The solutions that we now have are now significantly more cost-effective. So if I can click on here and go to a Shopify site, I can have 55 different ways to assist me with Shopify. It's easy to set up. Same with WooCommerce, same with Wix. There's so many now that allow you to do things quickly. It's a mental thing. It's a thing where I say, you know, psychologically, I can do this. Sometimes we do it because we have to. Sometimes we've got the humility to bring in people who are younger than us to do those things. But it's very doable. So the barriers aren't there. And I actually think the barriers are lower. The reach is much further because you're not dealing with just one geography. The flexibility is better. The cost base of running is significantly less. I mean, those 150 square metre sites are probably 50% of the cost of running an equivalent size, remember you're spinning inventory through, an equivalent size physical retail store. That's why we're seeing around the world, you know, asset values for physical retail are in massive decline. You know, zombie malls in the US, in the mini malls where there's nothing left, you know, whole chains going into receivership in the UK and in Europe. At the same time as you talk about that place has gone up by 10% in value in 12 months. Because there's a demand for people that want online warehousing logistics.
So the other big change in the whole world of retail is that in the past you'd have, you know, sales teams dashing about if you're a supplier of goods to the different retailers to sell in your latest and greatest. What's going to happen to those supply chains now?
Yeah, that's interesting. So what we're seeing is there are fewer doors and fewer buying offices around the world. So there are fewer physical places that you can sell product into that can be sold at physically in retail. And it's a genuine issue. So there are people who have been working, suppliers who've been supplying physical retailers, specific physical retailers for 20 years, and then they're not there. They're gone. while that's happening, there are all the marketplaces, all the category killers growing that they need to get on board with. This whole thing about a mindset, one of the businesses I'm involved in has done a phenomenal job for many, many years of providing really good shopper marketing services to physical retailers. You know, demonstrations, brand ambassadors, understanding how people flow through stores, they're experts at what they do. They've seen it and they've said, we're going to work with you, and we're also going to work with your online offerings, because we actually get the shopper, we understand the shopper, and then are developing online services that allow a sales team to go and deal with and work with and assist an pure online retailer with how they range their product, how they price it. We talk about all the images that carry the image and video library to be able to support the brands online. So there's a natural move into these areas because that's what's required. That's where the industries are going. Again, those who change and see it, great. Those who don't, get left behind.
And then another thing that popped up in our conversation today, going back to the Shopify's and the Wix, etc., is the importance of the shopper experience. Because fundamentally, if you're buying templates and if you're buying platforms, how do you stand out?
Yeah. So you and I were going through this in the research we're doing. So in the US, effectively, Shopify have a 31% market share. So they have a third of all e-commerce sites in the US are Shopify. Shopify offer 100 themed, so free or paid for themed layouts for their site. We know from Pareto, the Pareto principle of the 80-20 rule, that 80% of people have chosen 20% of those sites. So a third of the sites in the US use the same 20 layouts. That's great. So the two-edged sword of that is you can set up, you can run quickly, you've got a template that you can run with, but you're not creating point of difference. That's why the shopper experience, how you use that, how you bring your communities alive, how you display your product, how you talk about your values, how you use video, imagery, lifestyle shots, Trustpilot, feedback, all those things we talk about in the shopper experience, that's what is important for the differentiator. That's where the real move forward, the real essence of being a really good online retailer is there. It isn't doing the same thing. Now, I love Shopify, big fan, WooCommerce, big fan, love them all. But if I go to the sites, their partner support sites, it's phenomenally left brain. Oh my word, the acronyms around what you can and can't learn is unbelievable. But very few of them, in fact, I haven't found one that uses the phrase shopper experience. Not one. Now that's a big call out. I haven't seen one that uses the phrase shopper marketing, but I've seen all sorts of different development techniques and how we can use AFPC and what we can do with, but there's the whole emotional element of it has been an issue. And I think that also gives you a sense of the businesses, the history, the heritage of the online businesses. They were built by developers. They were left brain guys and girls. And little by little, we've seen the right brain guys and girls come in on the platforms and do more and more of the emotional elements, except that it can be done online.
Well, the wonderful news, of course, is that in fact, probably about now, there is one course that you can take to learn a lot more about the shopper experience, which is our own course, which we are just about to put the finishing touches on and will be available probably by the time you hear this podcast.
And so, I just need to make a call out to Nigel. Nigel is a brilliant, like truly brilliant, editor, director, producer. He is. I've known him for over a decade now, and I've seen the work he's done. And I've seen the work he does with amazing corporations. So when he says we're just about to launch a course, it's 14 months in the making. This is not just knocked over in the garden shed on a weekend. This is 14 months of research and work and reference. So, you know, credit where credit's due. He puts a mic in front of me and he puts me in front of a camera. But the structure of this, the way it has to be structured so people get the best from it, the research, the editing, unbelievable. So please don't think this is, oh, look, COVID's come along and Nigel and Kev are putting out a course. 14 months in the making. We sat here and we're sitting back in Queensland. We shot the first part of this 14 months ago. And it's taken us that time to get it right, to get the references right, to get the flow of it right, to make sure that people can learn from it and apply it to their businesses.
Yep, and going back to the word passion, we're both very passionate about the content and we believe that it's going to be of value to people.
Absolutely,
so,
yeah.
So if you'd like to find out more, go to our website, theroadtoretail.com, and check out all the info we have there about our new Shopper Experience online course and anything else to do with the shopper experience. Plus, if you want to catch up on previous podcasts, it's all on the website. Now, Kevin, earlier today you dived off to catch up with your bandmates.
I did indeed.
And you did a recording. What have you got for us today?
Well, this is, so those of you who've been listening to the podcast have been on this journey with us. So we started this journey when lockdown started, and there was beautiful music they'd written, beautiful lyrics. So John and Bob are the most amazing musicians, and I committed to them that what we'd do is we would release that music. It would not be lost. So in lockdown, we'd be able to record. This is the sixth track that's been released. As I said to Nigel on the podcast, so Nigel, since last week and this week, how many people do you think have been able to listen to a song? Oh, 10,000. Well, it's been laid up to 300 million people, 400 million people. If you take all the sites combined, Napster, Deezer, YouTube, the reach is unbelievable. So this is the sixth track. It's called Sun on the Water. Again, pumping track, lot of fun, lot of harmonica. Jump on the train, you'll enjoy this.
So here we go, Finding Cadence with
Sun on the Water.
For you will never die. Like a bird it flies high in the sky. Like a lion it roars down below. I just can't let you go. Sun on the water, stars in the sky. Like a true love they never die. Wake up, boy, control yourself. It's just another day. Forget the past, live for the future. It's just what friends will say. Chase your dreams and live your life. Find another love. Reach for the stars and take a chance. Wait for that mystic dove. Winding road through the desert sands. The sun beats down like a firebrand. The love within me burns like fire. To hold you close is all I desire. Sun on the water, stars in the sky. Like a true love, they never die. Life goes on, my heart is broken. Was your love for me just a token? I know this pain won't go away, so please come back to me and stay. Sun on the water, stars in the sky. Like a true love, they never die. Sun on the water, stars in the sky. Like a true love, they never die.